Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Emilio San Pedro, and in the early hours of Monday, the 5th of August, these are our main stories. President Trump has said hate has no place in the United States after the two mass shootings in Texas and Ohio that left a total of 29 people dead. Nguyen Chia, one of the architects of the mass genocide in Cambodia, has died at the age of 93. And the U.S. and the Taliban meet for another round of peace talks in Doha. Also in this podcast...
The old 40 is a woman 60 today, so why not continue along that process of making people feel younger, healthier, fitter?
We hear about a pioneering procedure to delay menopause. But first, the U.S. is no stranger to mass shootings, but the two that struck the country in a matter of hours on Saturday in El Paso, Texas, and Dayton, Ohio, in which 29 people were killed, have sparked renewed discussions on gun control, but also on the role President Trump's fiery rhetoric on issues like immigration could have played in inspiring the attack in El Paso. The authorities have said that the suspect in the case, 21-year-old Patrick Crucius, could face domestic terrorism and hate crime charges. He's believed to have published a manifesto online prior to the attack, in which he called it a response to the Hispanic invasion of the U.S. President Trump faced criticism from several of the Democrats seeking the party's nomination for the presidency, like Beto O'Rourke, who comes from El Paso.
You don't get mass shootings like these. You don't torch mosques. You don't put kids in cages until you have a president who's given people permission to do that. And that's exactly what's happening in the United States of America today.
President Trump had been spending the weekend at his golf resort in New Jersey, but he had this to say as he was boarding a plane a short while ago to return to Washington.
Hate has no place in our country, but just on behalf of our First Lady and myself, condolences to all. We have to get it stopped. This has been going on for years, but we've done actually a lot, but perhaps more has to be done. But this is also a mental illness problem. If you look at both of these cases, this is mental illness. These are really people that are very, very seriously mentally ill.
So will the president's words take the sting out of the criticisms? Anthony Zerker is our correspondent in Washington.
I think it's safe to say it will not be enough to quell those criticisms that you mentioned. He spoke in generalities. He said, we have to get it stopped. And a lot of things are in the works. And he talked about how he'd been in communication with members of his Justice Department and the governors of the two states involved here. But nothing concrete and nothing acknowledging the criticism that perhaps his rhetoric had any part in the attack.
And like many of his supporters that came out on Sunday onto the Sunday TV programs to defend him in America, Mr. Trump pointed directly to the fact, as he said, that these men were mentally ill.
Right. He talked about the mental illness, that this was a mental illness issue, which I'm sure people will begin to point out that he doesn't talk that way about international acts of terror, international militancy. In those cases, it's not a mental illness issue. Militant Islamic terrorism is the term that he tends to use, or radical Islamic terrorism. So they're going to point out the differences in rhetoric here. One of the things you have to keep in mind is that because of the ferociousness of the criticism that is being lobbed at Donald Trump, in particular by Democratic presidential aspirants, we're in the middle of a presidential race here, and Democrats who are in the contest are all clamoring to try to criticize Donald Trump and to blame him in some way for contributing to the rhetorical environment of this attack. That's not going to be something that Donald Trump responds well to in the past. He usually pushes back, so it conceivably could make it more difficult for Donald Trump to play any kind of a role, a presidential role as the consoler-in-chief. I have the feeling that he's going to be more inclined to respond to these criticisms with his own round of attacks, if not tomorrow, certainly in the days ahead.
And is there any sign that there'll be any discussion about gun control coming out of these latest attacks?
Every time there's an incident of gun violence, there are calls for new gun control. And whether this time, because it plays into the politics going on about white nationalism, because it's a presidential year, because perhaps there are more Democrats in Congress, or because maybe the National Rifle Association doesn't have quite the influence it did before, maybe that would change things. Although I have to say I wouldn't hold my breath quite yet.
Anthony Zerker in Washington. One of the former top members of Cambodia's Khmer Rouge, Nguyen Chia, has died at the age of 93. He was deputy to Pol Pot, whose regime was responsible for a genocide in Cambodia in the 1970s. Unlike Pol Pot, who died in 1998, Nguyen Chia was eventually brought to justice. Morgan Eyre has more details.
Nguyen Chia, the infamous brother number two, was the second in command during the brutal Khmer Rouge regime in Cambodia in the late 1970s, which saw around 2 million Cambodians die of starvation, disease, overwork and execution. It was a genocide known as the Killing Fields. As chief ideologue, Nguyen Chia tried to force through an agrarian communist society by abolishing class and start society from scratch, forcing millions of city dwellers to work in the countryside. One survivor told the BBC about his experiences.
Everyone educated had to be executed. Doctor, teachers, bankers, and if you wear glasses, spectacles, they think you were educated. I lost many of my relatives and they just execute them, took him away and never seen them again.
While these atrocities were carried out in the 70s, he was pardoned by the state in 1998, and it wasn't until international pressure forced the Cambodian government to arrest him in 2007. He was finally convicted for crimes against humanity in 2014, and he was sentenced to life in prison. Then, after a second trial last year, he was also found guilty of genocide and given another life sentence. But Nguyen Chia has remained largely unrepentant. Speaking to the BBC before he was convicted, this is what he had to say about his role in the killing fields.
Good humour is in my nature. It's my habit. If they have evidence to convict me, then that's fine by me. That's justice. I'm now 76. How long can they imprison me? If they jail me for 20 years, then I'll be 96.
Some victims were pleased with the conviction in 2014 and said they'd waited 30 years for a verdict. At the time, they said even if he died in prison, he wouldn't deserve a proper burial. Many former Khmer Rouge members, including current Prime Minister, have remained in government, and only three people have been charged for their role in the genocide.
Morgan Eyre. In October 2001, a US-led coalition launched attacks on Afghanistan to defeat the Taliban in the wake of the September 11th attacks. Nearly 18 years later, are we finally seeing the beginnings of peace between the two sides? Well, the US and Taliban representatives are meeting in Qatar. They're led by the US envoy for Afghanistan, Zalmay Khalilzad, and Taliban co-founder Mullah Baradar. Our chief international correspondent, Lise Doucette, is in Doha. So what is each side looking for?
For the Taliban, their main objective in talking to the United States is they want the United States and other countries to pull their troops out of Afghanistan, foreign forces out immediately. What the Americans are saying, no, this is a conditions-based pullout, a phased withdrawal. And they're now saying that all of the troops won't be gone until formal talks begin between the Taliban and an Afghan negotiating team, notwithstanding, of course, the fact that President Trump keeps saying, I want all the troops home before the next year's presidential election. So that's the big sticking point for the Taliban. One of the issues for the United States is they do not want a repeat of the events of September the 11th, 2001. They do not want Afghanistan to be a safe haven again for extremist groups. And they want that spelled out in black and white. But the Taliban are resisting. They don't want to say we will move against Al-Qaeda, we will move against Islamic State, because, of course, they fear they could come under attack by these groups. They want to use broad, sweeping language of extremist groups and terrorism. But the United States wants it to be absolute. Be clear.
Wouldn't striking a deal bilaterally with the U.S. only strengthen the Taliban? And where does this leave the Afghan government?
Indeed, the critics say that look at how much legitimacy the Taliban have now. They now travel around the world. They meet foreign ministers. All of this is giving them a lot of credibility and increasing their sense of power. But for those who support this agreement, they say there are issues that can only be discussed with the United States, and that is the future of American troops. They have to start somewhere. And the Taliban have always made it clear that until they have an agreement on the foreign troops, they're not going to sit down for formal negotiations with the Afghans. So if there is a chance at peace, they simply understand that they need to grab it. The Taliban know that, and all the other Afghans know that. But it's going to be hard.
Least to set. A procedure that promises to delay menopause has been given the go-ahead by medical regulators in Britain. It involves freezing ovary tissue from a young woman and reimplanting it in her later in life. This would allow her body to continue making the hormones that usually stop being produced at the time of menopause, acting as a sort of natural hormone replacement therapy, or HRT. James Kumarasamy spoke to the man who pioneered the procedure, Dr. Simon Fischel, who's famous for another groundbreaking procedure, IVF.
What we take is one half or one third of one ovary. It has a remarkable function, but it's only tiny. And then we divide it up very, very carefully into little strips. And then we deep freeze them. And we keep them at a very low temperature, about minus 150 degrees centigrade, where nothing happens to them biologically. And they can be kept frozen for many, many decades. And within that tissue is hundreds, if not thousands, of eggs. But as a part of that, it's the hormones that are being preserved that keeps a woman in her premenopausal phase. So once that tissue is transplanted back, then those hormones start producing. It doesn't matter how long we keep them. The delay will simply depend on the functionality of that actual tissue once it thawed out, which I think will be all about the age of the woman. So the younger you do it, the greater benefit you're going to have.
What are the benefits then?
About 70% of women experience symptoms going into the menopause and well into the menopause. And about 50% of them continue to seek medical help for their symptoms, including one of the very big ones, osteoporosis, cardiovascular disorders, even cognitive dysfunction. And of course, the more minor ones are things like hot flushes. I mean, I don't call them minor, they just relatively are, anxiety, and a raft of other conditions, mood swings, that debilitate an awful lot of women.
So by delaying the menopause, you are delaying all of that?
Yes, because you're keeping the woman in her pre-fertile period, her premenopausal period. Now, we try to do that medically using pharmacological drugs called HRT. Now, HRT isn't for everybody, but one of the reasons why HRT has its problems is because literally it is a pharmacological agent. It's delivered in a manner to the woman that is crude. It's not like our organs deliver our hormones with exquisite sensitivity in a rhythmical, pulsatile nature over a period of time. So that is one reason why having natural hormonal replacement, and I don't just mean the product being natural, it's the way it's delivered to the body, is likely to be of enormous benefit to women.
Does this mean that women will essentially be able to have children much later in life?
Yes. And of course, no. If they are in the older age bracket where it would be unsafe for the child and unsafe for the pregnancy and the woman, then we would put it somewhere where just the hormones will be active, but absolutely impossible to get pregnant.
That's fascinating. So is there an issue, though, potentially with women who are older, who feel younger, who are still fertile, have not gone through the menopause, who perhaps lose some of those sort of grandmotherly instincts that people say are very important as part of the social fabric?
Of course, we don't have the answer to that. What we do know is we're in a very interesting phase of human development. Maybe 150 years ago, women were not living much beyond their childbearing years. And now we have wonderful medical health opportunities. The old 40 is a woman 60 today. So why not continue that along that process of making people feel younger, healthier, fitter?
Dr. Simon Fischel speaking with James Kumarasamy. So to come on this podcast.
I really didn't think he would make it, but I was hoping and just to see him in the distance with my little binoculars was just amazing.
A Frenchman has become the first person to cross the English Channel on a jet-powered flyboard. The Turkish president, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, has announced that his country will launch a new military operation against U.S.-backed Kurdish fighters in northern Syria. He said it would focus on territory held by the YPG to the east of the Euphrates River. Turkey has already carried out several major incursions against the YPG west of the Euphrates. Our Arab Affairs editor, Sebastian Usher, reports.
The Kurdish YPG has built up a semi-autonomous enclave to the east of the Euphrates in northern Syria. Its key role in the defeat of the Islamic State group saw it coming across to the other side of the river and taking territory there. Turkey has launched previous offensives to drive the Kurdish fighters out of those areas. It regards the YPG as a terrorist group on a par with IS. But the situation is complicated by US backing for the Kurds. As the US winds down its military involvement in Syria, it has committed itself to helping create a safe zone on Syria's northeastern border with Turkey. But Ankara appears to have lost patience with Washington. An offensive against the Kurds to the east of the Euphrates could spark a major new conflict.
Sebastian Usher. 40 migrants rescued in the Mediterranean by a German charity have been taken to Malta after Italy turned them away. Malta only agreed to let them land after receiving assurances from Germany and other EU countries that they will take them all in. Danny Eberhard is the BBC's Europe regional editor and has been following the story.
Well, this is a vessel run by a German charity called CI. 40 people were aboard the ship, mainly West Africans. Italy said that it was forbidden from entering Italian territorial waters. This is part of the hardline interior minister in Italy, Matteo Salvini's policy of stopping charity boats bringing migrants to Italy. So it then diverted, it went to Malta. It was appealing to the Maltese authorities to let it in. Eventually, an agreement was drafted up, led by Germany and some other European Union countries, to take the migrants. So Malta then said, OK, we will take the migrants. They didn't let the boat into its own territorial waters. There was a transfer and they've now been disembarked on the island.
And why is it left now to charity ships to pick up migrants?
Well, there was an EU state presence. Operation Sophia had a naval vessels in the central Mediterranean patrolling. These were suspended in March. They now only have aerial reconnaissance. Italy has organised with the Libyans to a search and rescue area around Libya. The Libyan Coast Guard within Libyan waters takes control of that, and migrants are taken back to Libya. Now, this poses a problem. Libya itself is in the middle of a civil war, and the migrants that are taken back to Libya are put in detention centres. This is something that the UN says is completely wrong, and it has called on the European Union to reinstate patrols from state vessels.
And is the European Union any closer to crafting a long-term plan to dealing with this?
It's one of the thorniest issues in the whole of the bloc. Basically, there's a split between some countries who say, yes, we should be taking, redistributing migrants from frontline states and showing greater solidarity. But some states, notably countries like Hungary and Poland, are saying we will not take any migrants from other countries. They see it as part of their national sovereignty about who can come into the countries. This is all very much a long-term project. The incoming European Commissioner, Ursula von der Leyen, says that this is one of her priorities, but it's not clear how it's going to be resolved.
Danny Eberhard. A Canadian resident has returned home after spending over a decade in an Iranian prison for crimes he said he did not commit. Peter Goffin reports on the man's narrow escape.
The nightmare is finally over. Those were the words tweeted by Saeed Malakpour's sister when he'd finally set foot back on Canadian soil. It had been 11 years since the Iranian-born Mr. Malakpour was arrested. He'd been imprisoned, tortured, condemned to death in two separate trials, and seen his sentence commuted to life behind bars. Ultimately, he'd made a daring flight to freedom. It all began in 2008, when Saeed Malakpour returned to Iran to see his father, who was terminally ill. His visit coincided with a crackdown by Iranian officials on internet activity deemed immoral and un-Islamic. In Canada, Mr. Malakpour, then 33 years old, was a computer programmer, and he had created a free tool that helped people upload photos to the web. But Iran's Revolutionary Guard claimed that tool was being used to post pornography online. Mr. Malakpour made televised confessions to a litany of crimes that included posting pornographic images of religious leaders and hacking into the webcams of people who visited porn sites so he could film them. But in a letter to his family, Mr. Malakpour later said these were false confessions made while he was being tortured. He said he was electrocuted and threatened with sexual violence. And his sister, Maryam Malakpour, read a section of his letter at a human rights conference last year.
Several individuals armed with cables and batons struck and punched me. The left side of my body was paralyzed for 20 days. However, the physical tortures were nothing compared to the psychological torment.
Last week, Iran bowed to pressure from Canada and the United Nations and granted Mr. Malakpour temporary release on bail. He was only meant to be free for a few days, but he managed to flee the country and make it back to Canada. Very few details of this escape have been made public, but we do know it was coordinated by Maryam Malakpour with help from the Canadian government. Mr. Malakpour is now at home in the city of Victoria on Canada's west coast, but countless others remain in Iranian prisons under dubious circumstances.
Peter Goffin. Mashra Leila may be one of Lebanon's best-known rock bands with a growing international profile, but they've not been able to perform at a major music festival in their home country this year. The organizers of the Byblos Festival say they canceled Mashra Leila's concert to prevent bloodshed after church leaders accused the band of blasphemy and they began receiving death threats. Mashra Leila say they're victims of a vicious smear campaign, as our Beirut correspondent Martin Patience explains.
They're Lebanon's biggest rock band with fans across the world. Mashrou Leila's lead singer is a Muslim and openly gay. He sings about religion, politics and sexuality, all hugely sensitive topics in the Middle East. Lebanon has always prided itself on being freer than the rest of the Arab world. But church leaders here said Mashrua Leila's lyrics violated religious values. The band says they were subjected to a smear campaign, relying on fabrications that couldn't be further from the truth.
For us, we are the last barracks of Christians in the Middle East. We cannot really allow such things to happen.
Naji Hayek is a political activist who was involved in the social media campaign against the band.
Christians 100% feel under assault in this country and see the popular reaction about it. Look at what happened to us in all the neighboring countries. Christians have been kicked out of Iraq. They have been slaughtered in Syria.
People would be surprised to hear that Lebanese Christians are under siege. It's not as if you're being attacked in the street.
Well, there are different kinds of attack.
If they had blasphemed, as you said, why don't you trust the courts?
When you go to the court and you say blaspheme the country, the regular court does not want to raise a big flag about this thing, so they let them go. And we do not want them to go to jail, and we do not want to hurt them or to do anything like this.
But surely if they have blasphemed Jesus Christ, then they should be punished.
Well, there is a different view in Christianity about this. Jesus Christ allows you to blaspheme. It doesn't mean anything. But at the same time, touching our political identity, political Christian identity, has to be defended, and this is the way we defended it.
That's the heart of the matter.
That's the heart of it, yes, exactly.
Lebanon may have been rebuilt after its devastating civil war ended 30 years ago, but the country's sectarian divisions are never far from the surface, and they're often exploited.
If you try people in the streets, that means that you are no more a state. I'm Nizar Sarieh. I am a lawyer and executive director of the Legal Agenda. That is now everybody imposing his own law and his own rules. And that's what is what's scaring in this issue, that there are people who are trying to impose what they believe as right. It's mob justice.
This was always about far more than just a band. It's about how Lebanon views itself as a country. In many ways, it's similar to what we're seeing elsewhere in the world. But the danger here is that sectarianism can very quickly lead to violence.
Martin Patience reporting from Beirut. A daredevil French inventor has become the first person to cross the English Channel on a jet-powered flyboard. Sunday's stunt was Frankie Zapata's second attempt to cover the 35-kilometer stretch of water. He tried it last month but fell into the sea when he failed to land on a refueling platform. These people were watching when he landed.
I really didn't think he would make it, but I was hoping. And just to see him in the distance with my little binoculars was just amazing. And as he flew over, just amazing.
I didn't know what to expect. I thought it would be a historical thing, but it was really high tech. It was amazing.
I wish Kent had provided something more to cheer him in.
Yeah.
Yes, why didn't they have a brass band here? And
yeah.
It was magnificent.
Well, our reporter James Waterhouse has been following the story and he spoke to Alex Ritson.
On his arrival near Dover in Kent in the southeast of England, you see these three helicopters flanking this dark figure, this little dot in the sky, and then very quickly you're greeted with the sound of the five turbine jet engines under this skateboard-shaped platform that Frankie Zapata's standing on. He's got a backpack, he's got a dark suit, he's sort of a flying suit with a dark helmet, and it's proper superhero stuff. And he comes in to greetings of applause and lands in a very sort of comfortable fashion.
And it's the second time he's tried to do this, isn't it?
Yes, he tried last month and got into some difficulty. So if you imagine, he's wearing a backpack that's full of kerosene, which powers these jet engines. On his last attempt, part of the flight involves sort of halfway through this 22-mile crossing, landing on an elevated platform on a boat in the English Channel and sort of swapping backpacks and effectively sort of replugging that in and taking off again. And he got into some complications and ended up falling into the sea. So the attempt had to be abandoned. This time round, they used a bigger platform and a bigger boat, and it's got him over.
It just seems incredible that the idea of the hoverboard has been around since my childhood. Finally, someone has made one that works.
Exactly. Fans of Back to the Future will think about this as well. It makes the ferry and the Eurostar look, frankly, boring. Frankie Zapata, he's an inventor. He's an ex-world jet ski champion. He's previously developed sort of aquatic flying machines, so the ones you sometimes see on beaches where they use the water itself to propel in the air. Well, this is obviously an extension of that. We set off about 6 in the morning from close to Calais. It took him about 20 minutes to make the 22-mile journey, which is around 30 kilometres. It's too early to say whether the likes of you or I will be going for this instead of more conventional means, but it's certainly a serious feat getting across in this way.
James Waterhouse speaking to Alex Ritson. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. And if you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Emilio San Pedro. Until next time, goodbye.